Transportation Policy will come to order. Thank you. Order in the hall. Let's see, I think we've taken roll call and we have a quorum. Representative Dorholt is going to move the minutes of March 19, 2013, and that is so noted. And are there any corrections, additions, and so forth?
So moved.
All right. All in favor of ratifying the March 19th, 2013 at 2:21 p.m. in the basement hearing room minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Now we have, who would like to do the next minutes, approve those? We have February 10th, 2014. Do we have a volunteer? Representative Sundin will move the minutes of February 10th, 2014. Are there any corrections, additions, or changes? If
Mr.
not,
Chair,
why?
There is a correction.
Okay.
It should be February 10th, 2014.
Ah, so noted. All in favor of the minutes as amended, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. They are passed. Now we will move along to Representative Rosenthal's bill 1335. What is this about?
I don't know.
Now, what is the correct language? No, the correct language of moving this bill. Now, you don't do that now. You do it afterwards. Well, Representative Rosenthal, we have new language, as you know, when we introduce the bill. I don't know when they want it said, but we can say it right now.
Mr. Chair, actually, we're not going to use that amendment.
No, I don't mean that, Representative Rosenthal. We want to recommend that House File 1335 be re-referred to the District Finance Committee.
That's correct. Thank you.
All right. Is that what you would like?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1335 is a basically a common sense bill, a hit and run bill, if you will. What it does is it takes the word accident and turns it into collision, so there is no discrepancy when you hit something. It says that you must stop at a safe place and go investigate what you hit, whether it's a person, whether it's a car, whether it's a light pole. You just need to make sure that you know what you hit. So this gets away from any excuses about leaving the scene and saying, I didn't know what I hit. And we've had a couple of those cases in Minnesota and throughout the country. And I think this bill is a common sense bill. It's something that all of us in this room would do anyway without a bill, but we just want to make sure that everybody else feels the same way. It does not change any penalties. And we have a few testifiers today. And first, I'd like to introduce Chris, who's going to tell you an incredible story, and I hope you all listen very intently.
Are there questions, comments? Oh, excuse me. I didn't see that your name was on my list, but I see it now.
Chris Zell.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Sure. My name is Chris Zell, and I live in St. Louis Park. With my husband, two boys, and I work as an accountant. I'd first like to thank you for your time and consideration on this proposed legislation. I'm very grateful to be here. I'd like to thank Representative Rosenthal and Kelly for their and many others for their tireless work on this legislation. I'm here on behalf of my family, my dad, my brother, and my brother's widow. and I'm here to testify in support of this legislation. You see, my brother, Kane Thompson, was 26 years old, and he was killed by a hit-and-run driver while legally changing a tire on the side of the road on June 16, 2002. As you can imagine, it was a day that changed our lives forever. The driver that struck and killed Kane was charged and convicted with three felony counts, including hit-and-run. To be perfectly honest, the charges, the convictions, none of that really mattered to us. We felt we needed to focus on healing from this horrible ordeal instead of putting our energy towards that, as it did absolutely nothing to bring Kane back to us. However, after 7 years of appeals to the Minnesota Supreme Court and the ultimate reversal of the hit-and-run conviction, we could no longer sit back and watch. The Supreme Court said that the state failed to prove that he knew that he hit a person. We find this hard to believe. After all, he had a 230-pound man. He ran over and drug a 5-inch-thick tire from Kane's car with a flat tire of his own, a dent in his hood, and a broken-out headlight at about 12 o'clock at night. The pure and simple fact is he didn't stop to investigate. The Supreme Court reversal has basically paved the way for future drivers to claim ignorance as to what was hit. It's already been used several times in different hit-and-run cases, most notably the Amy Sensor case. It's very difficult to know what a driver knew at the time of a collision. It also encourages drunk or other impaired drivers to leave the scene instead of offering possible life-saving assistance. This legislation requires drivers to stop and investigate what was struck. This change would help many people and quite possibly save lives. Every time I hear of a story, another hit-and-run story on the news, I am first sick to my stomach about how that family has just been torn apart. And secondly, I'm appalled to know that I'll probably again be hearing about how the driver is going to use this reversal to benefit themselves. It is incomprehensible to me that we allow this to continue, and the time has come for the statute to be fixed. So your thoughtful attention would be much appreciated. Pass it, and let's move forward holding people accountable for their actions. Thank you.
Let's see. Name, Kelly.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kelly Moeller, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Alliance on Crime today. I'm also a prosecutor, and I was previously an appellate prosecutor, and I handled the case involving Chris's brother, Kane. The name of that driver is Mohammed Al-Nazir, and as she said, the Supreme Court reversed Al-Nazir's conviction because the state failed to prove that Al-Nazir knew he struck a person or a car. And notably, the Supreme Court said in its opinion that there may be a shortcoming in the statute because the legislature may want to require drivers involved in accidents to stop for the limited purpose of determining what it is they've struck. So this bill today fixes that shortcoming, and it closes the loophole that allows drivers who strike and end up killing a person or injuring a person or damaging a car to evade responsibility. This bill does not change anything else other than adding the requirement that drivers stop and investigate what was struck. I believe the bill summary that you received indicates that it makes additional provisions about remaining at the scene and providing information mandatory. Those provisions are already in the statute, so it doesn't change the requirements once someone stopped and determined what it is they've hit. A driver who does not stop and investigate is not going to be criminally liable for failure to stop unless they have, in fact, hit a person or another car. This change could make the difference between life and death. We have support letters from the County Attorneys Association, the Sheriff's Association, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Minnesotans for Safe Driving, and the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota. Thank you.
Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rosenthal, thank you for bringing this bill forward. We discussed this before committee, and I think you're heading in a good direction. I looked at the language here of the bill online. Where do we start? 112. 1.12, where it says reasonably investigate what was struck. If the driver knows or has reason to know the collision resulted in an injury to or death of any individual, the driver in every event shall remain at the scene of the collision until after the driver has fulfilled the requirements and so forth. As we discussed a little earlier, I think that, that the intent of this bill is honorable, and I could support this, but there needs to be some changes that are made to this, and we discussed that a little bit. Historically speaking, there are some areas where for those of you that don't know, I've been in public safety for 26 years, and I have personally witnessed this three times in my career. There have been three different occasions where a driver has hit a young child. The driver stopped in the minutes that followed between the collision and the arrival of the police. The driver, in three different occasions, was pulled from the car and beaten within inches of their life by the community, by the neighborhood, people that live in the neighborhood. Okay, three times I've witnessed this in 26 years. Most recently, out on the East Coast, there was a family that was in an SUV. They were in traffic, and they had some type of a collision with a group of people on motorcycles, and it was very well established in the news how this motorcycle group continued to pursue this vehicle, and they pulled the driver out, and they attempted to extract their own form of vengeance, so to speak, and it became very ugly, and the driver of the vehicle was in fear of their life. What needs, in my opinion, to be added to this bill is some type of provision that stopping does make sense to see what you hit. That is a common sense thing. But if you have any reasonable fear for your safety or the safety of the other people in your car, being required to remain there at the scene to take your life in your hands, like I have personally witnessed three times, and like we saw play out in the news just recently, I think is something that we need to address. Some form of amendment between now and in the next committee hearing, which would address the personal safety factor. If we can get that into the bill, that's something that I think is necessary and I could get behind. So, thank you.
Let's see. I got to look back at my list to find out. Oh, that's Kelly Moeller.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I would say that the statute as it's currently written and what we're doing to it has, it, as part of this, the person must stop at the scene or as close to the scene as possible, and there's also a requirement under subdivision 6 that the driver has to, after complying with this, give notice to law enforcement. So I would argue that in that situation that you described, it would not be possible for the driver who fears for their safety to stay at the scene, but as long as they called law enforcement after the crash, that would cover that situation that you described.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Rosenthal.
Representative Neuberger, we did briefly talk before this, and I sort of alluded to the same thing, and of course we want everybody to be safe. So, you know, I'd be willing to look at, you know, what that means, calling the police from a block away or two from the incident. But clearly there is protection in this bill. If we can make it better, that would be great.
Any other questions or comments? Well, I guess we're all done with. Oh, Jared. Jared, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Jared Jordahl. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Department of Public Safety. I just wanted to testify briefly on this bill. The department is very supportive of the concept of this legislation. We think that a identified loophole has been discovered here that should be closed, involving ignorance of what is struck and a requirement to stop. My only thoughts with respect to this bill, and I've been working with Ms. Moeller over the course of the weekend, we've been trying to do some wordsmithing on the fly to make this work, is it's a little bit semantic wise, but the statutes are currently interspersed with the word accident, with respect to auto accidents and accident reports, this sort of thing. We are trying as an agency to shift the dialogue and the mindset to the word crash. That is the word of choice, so to speak. And now this bill, having the word collision, we will potentially have, as we try to transition to crash, and this bill has a smidgen of collision, and accident is predominant throughout the statutes, we worry there might be some confusion. We very much, as I said, are in support of the concept of this bill, would like to make it work, are going to continue to work with Representative Rosendahl and with the Senate author, Senator Dahl, with Ms. Moeller, and with anyone else who would like to sit down and brainstorm this, but it is kind of a conundrum. We publish, you know, the bill as it stands cross-references, and I think in the works would trimming this down, but it cross-references accident reports that our agency does and renames them collision reports. Some of this might have some minor effects. Some of it might have profound consequences that I'm sure were unintended. So we hope to work closely as this moves forward. I understand this is going to another committee, and we are committed to make it work because we do feel strongly that it, the underlying concept of the bill is an important one, and it does merit moving forward and making it to the governor's desk.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Jordahl. And my name is Rosenthal, so we'll call the other author Rosenthal.
Sorry.
Author Thal, or Dahl. Anyway, I agree with you, and this was just brought to my attention, and we want to work with you and make sure that the statutes align. Was my understanding just before this committee, I was made aware of it, that there might be some problems with federal statute and the word accident, so we will take care of that on the next committee.
Yes.
Anybody else? Anybody else in the audience? Seeing none, we will again move, I guess. I don't know if you're supposed to do this under the new rules or not. But
thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 335 be referred to the House Judiciary Committee.
Judiciary Finance.
Excuse me. Judiciary and Finance, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Okay. All in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Well, you're on your way as a good recommendation for this committee. What are we going to do now? Okay. You want this over there, or is he going to come up here?
I don't know. Would that be better?
Representative, are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay. If you would proceed, please.
Madam Chair, I would, I think we introduced it the same way as we would introduce the bill by saying I recommend that House File 2149 be referred to the General Register.
Thank you. Proceed.
Both before and after, or what? I don't know. But anyway, what we're looking at here is a a bill that brings to focus an idea that's been floating around for 10, 15 years, and that is to provide a third lane on 494 between roughly, and I'll pass this out, which it's hard to see, but scribbling, but we will put it out there, between basically the Crosstown Commons, or not Crosstown Commons,
394. 55 and Fish Lake.
Well, there's some dispute about that, but I'll let you
change. You changing his bill?
If I'm incorrect, then correct.
Well, if you look at the map, it looks differently than that, but that's all right. Anyway, and finally, some resolution was beginning to form around the fact that they wanted to try a new experiment along there and put in a dynamic shoulder, dynamic lane, instead of preparation for what is now the standard, the managed lane. Now, I have a, can you see that, Mr. Burris? That's the way color copies. We don't have anybody here from MnDOT, I guess. Oh, we do. Uh-huh. Where are the people that wrote the letters to me? Why aren't they here? I don't know, but it's interesting. Because I was going to ask permission to use... Oh, there he is. Can I pass out the letter you wrote me? If you prefer not to, I'd be happy. You don't remember? I have a copy you can read. Is it all right or no? Okay. He just describes... Scott Peterson from MnDOT described to me what had been going on there and what the possible solutions are. And I thought I had a bunch of those here, too. Yeah, right here. Now, the difference between a managed lane and a dynamic shoulder is that the managed lane, I'm going to give you these over here. I'm going to get the managed lane is open for business when the traffic is heavy at a toll, and the rest of the time when the business of the road is to carry just general traffic and so forth, they open all the lanes to everyone. Dynamic shoulder, on the other hand, is open only when the traffic is heavy, when it's congested, and it's closed the rest of the time. So you've got a lot more advantages to the managed lane. Now, I don't believe from the letter that you're going to find that they're going to immediately build a managed lane there. What we're asking for is that the lane be full general purpose lane, and one day they may convert everything from St. Cloud to the airport into a managed lane. Maybe not quite that much, but close. So as they build out, and that's what we are about today, and that is to establish the fact that we would like to have a general purpose third lane there rather than a dynamic shoulder. And I have several witnesses from that area who have been struggling with this for years, and would like to have Mayor Kelly as the first on the list, if you would like to come forward.
Welcome to the committee.
By the way, that we can bring down here and get
Hi, thank you for allowing me to be here to testify, and I think I may be going out of order on your list, and my 16-year-old son needs stitches, so I'm going to testify and run back and get that taken care of. But I do have our city manager here from Plymouth as well that is going to hang around and will answer any questions, if there are any, after I leave. So,
would you introduce yourself first?
Kelly Slavik, Mayor of Plymouth. You. So thank you for letting me go first. Although the city of Plymouth has had a long history with this project, we're the only segment of 494 in the metro area that's two lanes. The rest of the corridor is at least three lanes or four lanes. And so when you take those three lanes or four lanes and to compress them down into two lanes as you go through Plymouth, there is a traffic jam every day, whether it's weather-related, whether there's an accident, whether it's people trying to get to their cabin, there is congestion and there's blockage. This has created an issue in Plymouth with people, not just with our residents sitting in traffic, but it also has created a problem for our businesses. They can't get their employees to and from work. They can't get goods and services out of Plymouth. We have over 46,000 jobs in our community. We have a medical device area in Plymouth that is really growing, and they're adding businesses and they're adding jobs. And I hear from them quite often that they are hurt by the fact that 494 is congested, and they've actually had to make schedule changes in their deliveries and their employees' schedules to get to be efficient in our community. And it's not just an issue that affects Plymouth residents or Plymouth businesses. It's really a regional issue, and I know that the mayor of Maple Grove, our neighboring community, is going to testify today, too, to let you know of their concerns. While I really appreciate MnDOT's creativity in coming up with a dynamic shoulder, really the issue is we need a permanent lane like the rest of the corridor. A dynamic shoulder is a temporary fix designed to last about 15 to 20 years. We need a permanent solution, and I think it's fair to do it right the first time. There is a funding issue. There's a shortfall of about $25 million between doing the dynamic shoulder and the permanent lane, and we've been working very closely with MnDOT to identify sources for that funding, and I think you'll hear from MnDOT today as well. But I think it's really a wise choice of tax dollars to do it right the first time and not have to come back in 15 or 20 years and do it right when we can do it right the first time. I recognize that funds are limited and that there's a lot of competition to get these dollars and to get these roadways improved, but it would really provide a high level of congestion relief in our community and in the region. We have over 72,000 residents in Plymouth, and it's been a great frustration. I hear from people all the time that they're missing things and they're late and they can't get in and out of Plymouth because of this issue. Plymouth is still a growing community. We're the sixth largest city in the state, and we have great schools. We have many things that are drawing people to Plymouth, and we're still growing and developing, and we have people that are wanting to move to Plymouth but recognize the frustrations that 494 creates. So we really want to do this right the first time and get it done. We have learned that through MnDOT that a dynamic shoulder will only provide about 85% relief in this corridor, whereas a permanent third lane would provide greater relief. This has been a long, ongoing issue. I think I was here last year and testified as well. But we were always told that we're going to do this in pieces, and we're going to start out in Bloomington. They're going to get their third lane on 494. And it worked through Eden Prairie and Minnetonka. When it came to Plymouth, I think priorities changed, funding became more scarce, and we're sitting with two lanes. So we really are just asking for some equity and get this corridor completed and get it done right. So I would really appreciate any consideration that you have. This is a very important project in Plymouth. I've been working on this for over a decade now and would really like to see some progress here. So thank you for any support that you can offer. Representative Earhart, thank you as well for taking up this cause.
Thank you.
Next. Again, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Deb McMillan. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Twin West Chamber of Commerce. The Twin West Chamber of Commerce represents 700 businesses that employ more than 50,000 people in the western suburbs of the Twin Cities. Interstate 494 is a main transportation artery in that region and critical to the efficient and safe movement of goods and people throughout the region. Currently, a dynamic shoulder is being proposed for the stretch of I-494 from Highway 55 in Plymouth to the Fish Lake Interchange. It is important to note that this is the only stretch of the I-494-694 loop that does not have at least three permanent lanes, general purpose, that will handle the traffic that moves in and around the Twin Cities each day. Therefore, it is understandable as traffic reaches this pinch point, the current system is unable to efficiently handle the traffic, and a problem that is exacerbated during peak travel times. It's also important to note that the dynamic shoulder is admittedly a temporary solution and delivers only about 85% of the benefit that a permanent third lane would. Residents and commuters will endure construction and traffic delays only to be faced with additional construction and traffic delays in a few years when MnDOT returns to create a permanent third lane in each direction, one that was needed in the first place. It's important to complete this portion of the regional transportation system to the standards that the rest of the system was completed. A general purpose third lane is a better long-term solution to the increasing traffic on I-494, and in addition to being a better and more efficient use of taxpayer dollars. Therefore, we urge you to support replacing the dynamic shoulder lanes currently planned with an additional general purpose lane in each direction. In your packets today, you'll find a letter signed by a coalition of businesses in support of the general purpose third lane, along with a letter from Jason Gaines, who is the vice president of Abbott Northwestern West Health, also expressing support of the permanent lane solution. Mr. Gaines couldn't be with us today, so with your permission, Madam Chair, I will read his testimony as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is from Jason Gaines, who is the vice president of Abbott Northwestern West Health. Thank you for allowing me to provide my perspective on the inclusion of a permanent third lane on I-494. As the vice president of Abbott Northwestern West Health, I'm writing to express my support for the inclusion of a permanent third lane on I-494 between Highway 55 and the Fish Lake Interchange. Abbott Northwestern West Health is a large, multi-specialty healthcare facility located at the intersection of Highway 55 and I-494 in Plymouth. Our facility currently includes over 50 primary and specialty care clinics, in addition to a bustling outpatient surgery center, imaging department, and now a 24/7 emergency department and urgent care, which treated 40,000 patients last year. Our facility has become a destination healthcare provider for a significant number of residents who live in western Hennepin County, and many of these patients use I-494 to access our services. The addition of a permanent third lane to I-494 is important because we routinely hear from both our employees and patients that traffic congestion on I-494 delays their ability to access our facility and often forces them onto adjacent side streets. With the addition of our new emergency department, we now have ambulances coming to and from our facility, often as frequently as 10 times per day. A permanent third lane is essential to ensure that our ambulances are able to transport patients to and from our facility quickly during peak traffic hours. As a key employer in this area who is planning to make additional commitments to this campus, we see the ease of accessibility to our facility as critical to our long-term investment in this community. Please support the addition of a permanent third lane to I-494.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, are we going to ask questions of witnesses later or now as they come up, or how would you like to handle that?
Okay. Do you have a preference, Representative Erickert? Okay. Why don't we just take questions as they're coming right now?
Okay. Well, I have a question for Ms. McMillan then. Good, compelling testimony. I appreciate it. I know the mayor, I was going to ask her, but I think she was going to go to help her son, so I didn't want to keep her, but and I think you referred to this as well, that identifying other sources of money, and that we're talking about $25 million perhaps extra for this, and you know, I'm a fan of managed lanes in terms of shoulders, in terms of the requests that you have, does the Twin West Chamber support additional revenue? Because right now, you know, we don't have additional bonding capacity. We're just, you know, we had an initial $300 million for corridors of commerce, and we've hit the limit. And, you know, MnDOT, I think, correctly says that for projects like this and for I-94 and 23, and we could go around the table. I know everyone's interests here. We need new revenue. And so it could be a gas tax. It could be a gross receipts tax for roads and bridges. I don't know. We can't do more debt at this point. So Does the Twin West have a position on new revenue for roads and bridges?
Currently, we are not supporting...
Ms. McMillan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, we don't have a position on supporting any new revenue.
Okay, so you're not for it or against it. You're kind of neutral. Madam Chair, you don't...
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, that's correct.
Okay, well, I would encourage you for this project and others that... And MnDOT has testified to the Finance Committee to this many times that, you know, this is an important project, and $25 million is, you know, probably in the medium range in terms of the requests we get. You know, we hear about Highway 14. We hear about all these corridors. In order to fund them, we're going to need new revenue. And so I'm sympathetic, but I think we also need support from the cities along this corridor, your chamber, other chambers, to really... you know, push for new revenue, because that's the one way that this is going to happen. I don't see, when we talk about identifying other sources, as the mayor suggested, I don't see those other sources right now. And so we just encourage you on that, to have your chamber take a position in support of new revenues.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Representative Earhart.
The bulk of this money has already been... earmarked for this project, in that, and you're right, we do need more money. But the dynamic lane was already shovel ready for dynamic shoulder was already shovel ready for April or May. I don't remember which. When we changed. Directions and said, well, let's do it right, then there's an additional charge factor in here. We'll be working on that, but nevertheless, this is not a request for money by right now. It is only a request that we expediently finish this properly and with a third full lane. And we're not asking for money now. We'll see if we can squeeze that out of various sources after we get this on solid ground. And I don't know, I have a different list of who is speaking up here, so I don't know whoever.
Next I have Mayor Mark Stevenson of Maple Grove.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I am Mark Stevenson, the Mayor of Maple Grove, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk about I-94 and the expansion to include a general lane. I think that for our communities in the northwest suburbs, whether it's Plymouth, Maple Grove, or elsewhere throughout the area, we need this third general lane. My law office, overlooks 494 every day, about halfway in between this area. Yesterday, the delay was a three-hour delay. The cars sat there for 3 hours, from 6:30 in the morning to 9:30 in the morning, essentially not moving at all. Maybe that's a little bit worse than usual, but I don't know that it's all that atypical for that section of 494 and going south. I think that this committee needs to know and understand that it traditionally is probably one of the worst, if not the worst, bottleneck currently in the Twin Cities, because it's only two lanes. Obviously, 494 through the other sections in the metro area is three or four lanes wide. This road is highly traveled by a number of people. And it greatly affects not only our residents, but anyone who travels in the Northwest Corridor to St. Cloud on a daily basis or for, you know, recreational purposes. And I think that it's important for this state, if we want to continue to move forward with the growth of our commerce, through the growth of jobs, that we continue to expand these type of roads. I think it's important, as we look at this road as well, that, you know, the dynamic shoulder, well, it's an idea that helps some of the traffic. I don't think it really provides the full purpose that this road needs, nor what was planned for years and years. And I think that MnDOT, I believe, has tacitly realized that as well. Certainly, 694 had the same type of dynamic shoulder lane that was passed as a part of last year's quarters of commerce, or also in a different part of the bill. They've re-looked at that part of the road, and I think they've decided that 694 needs a general purpose lane in that area instead of a dynamic shoulder lane. I would submit to this committee that this section of 494 is very similar. It needs this type of full general purpose lane to effectuate and really serve the best purposes of our citizens, to help them in their daily lives, to help them in their jobs, and really to make the best use of our limited dollars. I mean, I think this is a great project for that limited use, and I really would appreciate the committee's support on this bill.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Any questions? I see the next testifier is ready.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, thank you for hearing us today. My name is Brad Aho. I'm currently serving in Eden Prairie on my third term as city council member. I also serve as chair of the I-494 Corridor Commission, and that commission is a group of five cities. We're a member of Eden Prairie, Edina, Bloomington, Richfield, and Minnetonka, and so we represent quite a few communities, and we are very much as a result of that organization in support of a third lane on 494 as well. We feel that the dynamic shoulder lane, while it's an innovative idea by MnDOT to come up with a way to use limited funds, we feel that really an additional funding of $25 million to effectuate a full third lane is really necessary. I also serve on the board of Southwest Transit, the opt-out bus service, and we have been using shoulders recently on 494 in the south area, and we feel that if you did a dynamic shoulder, you would not really open up that possibility for having buses to use the shoulder in addition when you have peak travel times. And we feel that the full third lane would really open up that opportunity as well. And so I think we're really missing a lot more that when we do a dynamic shoulder as opposed to the third lane. Also, you was alluded to, but I don't think we've really covered it, and that is when you have these backups, what happens is you get a lot of cut through. So people are like water. They're going to flow through on the most direct, fastest route when they're trying to get to work or trying to get home. And so what they're going to do is they're going to cut through those communities. And I know Maple Grove and Plymouth both see a lot of cut through traffic. And that cut through traffic is problematic for a lot of reasons. It's problematic because the roads aren't designed to handle those loads. It's a safety issue, and it just causes a lot of wear and tear on those roads for those cities. So we would really appreciate that you consider looking at doing this right. When I talked to people and said I'm coming here to testify on this bill, they said, what do you mean only one lane? We're adding one lane. Why aren't we adding two lanes to this section? It really needs more capacity. And if you go to any other city in the United States, their ring roads, their major thoroughfares have much more capacity than our cities here in Minneapolis. And we really need better roadways. We need more infrastructure. If we're going to remain competitive, I also am a small business owner, and I know how transportation affects businesses. And businesses, if we're going to be competitive on a statewide basis and a global basis and a national basis, we really need better infrastructure to make that happen. So thank you for hearing us today. I'll stand for questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Oh, Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to either the mayor or to the council person, and thank you for your testimony. I really appreciate it. It really helps me get a sense of the local impact, so I appreciate that. But my question is about, you mentioned the impact on safety, and one thing I haven't heard, and I'm just going to ask the question, is do you have any traffic fatalities over the last several years that are attributed to this particular section of 494?
There are. I don't have those figures in front of me today. What I do have, though, is currently we have the volume on that section of roadway is approximately 100,000 vehicles per day. So think of 100,000 vehicles per day on that section. We're looking at the Met Council and others' projected volume in 2030 is 133,000 vehicles. So we're talking about a 33% increase by 2030. So if you think of what it is today, think of adding 33% more to that, it's going to get worse. So that really greatly affects safety and accidents. I don't know, Mayor, do you have any figures on that?
I don't have any figures exactly, but anecdotally, I know I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Representative Simonson, I know anecdotally that I see accidents. I see the police responding. I see the ambulances on the road. I know that there are a lot of accidents on that roadway today because of its structure, because of the way you have two lanes from 694 coming together with two lanes from 94. You have a system where you take those four lanes and you today crunch them into two lanes in a very short period of time, it results in accidents in that section that if we had three full lanes going that direction would be eliminated in my viewpoint from what I've seen. And from having driven the roadway and knowing how people have to try and drive and get together, it causes accidents.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up, so and I think that if you go around the table here, you could solicit examples of transportation needs across the state where we have several examples of, you know, really dangerous situations where we've had multiple deaths related to the transportation needs. So I understand what you're saying about the need and the convenience factor. I understand that and I support that, but I think we can come up with many scores of examples that are similar across the state. But I do want to follow up and ask one final question, Madam Chair, and then I'll be done. But I want to take off of where Representative Hornstein left off and ask you two. I mean, the reality is, I understand this bill's not asking for $25 million, but the reality is that essentially we're asking MnDOT to come up with $25 million to accomplish this. And I just want a general sense of, from both of you, is what you feel about transportation funding. How do we pay for that? Because I'm pretty sure MnDOT's going to come down here and testify and tell us that they don't have the money to do this.
Madam Mayor. Chair, Representative Simonson, I guess first of all, from my perspective, I think we need additional funding. I know that, for instance, the gas tax is diminishing in size and scope as the miles per gallon of a vehicle increase, and so our sales tax decreases, and we need to figure that out. How we figure that out or what we do, I'll leave that to you. I'm sure you're thankful for that. But
thank you.
Yes, but I do think that realistically we need additional funding in this state to handle our road system. I mean, we have to be realistic about it. It needs additional funding. We need to build additional roadways. We talk in our state a lot about wanting to create a better community for our people to live in, a better place for jobs to come to. And I think that if we are going to say that, we need to have the transportation system that corresponds to what we talk about. I would agree with Councilmember Aho. I mean, you go around the country, they oftentimes have 3-4 lanes. I know I was in Phoenix last fall for work, and, you know, I think that the lanes there that I was traveling on were 6 lanes each direction. I think that's the investment they've made. So I just think that there is additional funding needs that we need to address, and how we're going to best do that, I guess I have to leave that to the legislature, but I would support additional funding in some fashion.
Mr. Ahill.
Madam Chair and Representative Simonson, I agree. I think we as a 494 Corridor Commission bring this topic up just about every meeting, that we really need to identify new and more stable sources of funding for transportation. Transportation is key to our existence as a state. We really need to have better infrastructure built, and so we need to find a way to raise the money. And I think we're starting to see businesses start to get on board with this. Hence, we had a member of Twin West Chamber here testifying, and I think you're going to start to see businesses starting to get more on board with this topic and finding ways to help raise the money, because it is critical and we can't ignore it any longer. I think Minnesota has had their head in the sand for too long and ignoring this topic, and we can't afford to do it anymore if we want to attract businesses to our communities and have them be here and be viable. We need the infrastructure to do it.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Yes, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the testifiers, Mayor, Council Member, thank you. You said the cost for this was $25 million, correct? The estimated cost.
Neuberger, yeah, I believe that the additional cost would be in the area of $20 to $25 million. And I think that the proposal from MnDOT, or the discussions I have heard, are essentially that they would delay for a year or two or three the dynamic shoulder lane. In the meantime, there would be additional funds found from some other source to pay for the additional $25 million. I mean, certainly that's, I think, what their plan is to currently do for the same similar shoulder lane in 694, where they're going to find the additional money now to fund that road general purpose lane today.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is kind of general. I'll pose this to Representative Earhart. Didn't the state just post a, correct me if I'm wrong, but a $1.23 billion surplus?
Well, you're correct there, Representative. That does represent some money that could be used for many purposes if you can squeeze it out of the speaker or whoever is going to be in charge of that.
Representative.
I think you're better apt at that. Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know it's Policy Committee, but since we want to wade into the finance thing, I will point out that when people say we're out of money, not exactly true. This committee on the finance side pulls in about $2.5 billion a year. That's a lot of money. Thing is, we have demands on that for maintenance and running overhead and things like that, and there's always a pot for new construction. This would probably come under the reconstruction portion. So to find another $25 million basically means the project gets bumped another year because, as I mentioned, there's about $2.5 billion a year that rolls into highway projects in this state, roads and bridges projects. And I was going to echo Representative Neuberger's comments that there is a prohibition against taking gas tax money to the general fund, but there is no prohibition against taking general fund money to the highway department. And indeed, the legislature, when last time we had a $2 billion surplus, I believe in the year 2000, appropriated their $450 million of general fund money, the House did, to the highway department. Said, here you go, MnDOT, catch up on all these projects we've been talking about for years and years. We could do that again, and I think you'd find a lot of support from some members on this side of the aisle if you wanted to do that, Representative Earhart. Thank you for the comment.
Thank you. Mr. Ahal,
I was just going to, Madam Chair and members, I was just going to bring up that the total cost of the project right now is estimated at about $94 million, so at a $25 million additional to accomplish the total project, and that's all I was going to add.
Thank you. We have one more testifier, is John Griffith here.
As a matter of fact, Madam Chair, if you read the letter from MnDOT's Scott Peterson, he's suggesting that they're going to do certain work on it this spring anyway on the bridge, on the bridges, because no matter what happens, that has to be done, and that was already programmed. So I think that's right.
Welcome to the committee, and if you identify yourself, please.
Sure. Madam Chair, John Griffith. I'm the West Area Manager for the MnDOT Metro District. Members, there's been a lot of numbers been thrown around and some speculation on what we're planning on doing. Hopefully I can clear that up a little bit. We currently were moving down a path to do a dynamic shoulder lane, which had a letting in June of this year. We currently have delayed that project letting, and we have a couple smaller other project lettings that still allow us to do that work if we chose to continue to pursue down that route. We have a steel letting in March of this year, and then we also have a temporary staging project that's going to be let in the June 2014 timeframe that the DSL project was going to be let. We currently have delayed the DSL project to January of 2015, and the delay does not delay the final product in terms of the opening of what we expected in terms of the dynamic shoulder. The construction would end in 2016, so that January start date does not prohibit us from, doesn't slow us in regards to that final product end date. What it does do is allows us to take a step back and look at what it would take to get a dynamic shoulder turn to a general purpose lane. And as the number has been mentioned, right now we think that that cost range is in that $25 million to $30 million price tag, in addition to what we had already programmed for the DSL project. That high number has a lot of risk in it, in contingency, so we want to make sure that as we move forward with the discovery process is that we don't cut ourselves short. So the $25 million is maybe on that low end, but we want to make sure that we have enough contingency with the stuff that we don't know to date. So right now, the DSL is estimated at $68.4 million, and the general purpose would run us between $93 million and $98 million. My understanding is that there's been a fiscal note request of MnDOT this morning on that, so the range that I gave you is not an exact number from MnDOT, but just a range from a design engineering standpoint. As part of our work, some of the reasons for the increase in cost or that range in cost is the additional ponding that's required with the general purpose lane, and the water resources requirements by delaying the project kicks us into some new requirements for ponding, so the additional ponding requirements might cause some additional right-of-way that's needed for those ponds. One of the other things that beyond the funding requirements is a policy that currently any new capacity that we're adding needs to be managed in some form. So our because of our limited dollars and that we don't have unlimited funds to address the capacity needs is how do we systematically address those capacity needs, and one of the things that we've done with policy is that we should be managing that. The DSL, although not priced, it was in the form of being managed in that we opened up those lanes during the peak hour of congestion and addressing roughly 85% of those needs when we expect congestion. It doesn't, if we had a snow event or events happened that were unpredictable, obviously we still have a two-lane system out there. So that's one of the things that we also are looking at is that policy question and moving through our Met Council.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay. Are there any questions then from the audience on this legislation?
I have done this before with MnDOT, Madam Chair. I find that with a little improvement here or there, maybe another year we get a superior product because they are trying to do something and make it go to satisfy at least, as we say here, 85% of the problem. And I think it's best to do a little more digging and get it done what I'm calling right, which is the full third lane. And that's how I happened to get in here and start shuffling things around. So,
thank you. Representative, do you want to move that House File 2149 be referred to the general
Madam Chair,
register?
Could I add one more comment on that?
Proceed.
A delay in the decision or moving forward with a general purpose versus the dynamic shoulder lane, because of the requirements or the design that we would have to move forward with, is that if we're delayed beyond what we think that we can deliver a January project, is that we would probably delay that project even further. So our decision in forthcoming is critical in regards to that January 2015 date. The DSL could certainly move forward. We have that project design and we'll call it shelf ready. But a general purpose lane has not been designed yet. We do not have all the details of that. So again, a delay in a decision certainly affects our ability to deliver a general purpose project in January of 2015.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask if you had the additional $25 million, would that speed it up at all?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, in regards to the design effort in the environmental documents, January is going to be very tight in regards to that. And it actually corresponds with the work that we have with the smaller projects that we have let, is that temporary staging sets us up this year. So even if we did advance it, that work probably wouldn't start until next year anyways.
Thank you. Again, do you want to re-refer your bill to the General Register?
Yes, I would recommend that House File 2149 be re-referred to the General Register.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Okay. The motion does pass, and it will be referred to the General Register. Thank you. Okay, next bill. Representative Earhart, 1796.
see, Madam Chair, I would very awkward the way that we are doing this. I'm going to recommend that House File 1796 be referred as amended to the Civil Law Policy and Finance Committee, even though it hasn't been amended yet.
Okay. Proceed, please, Representative Earhart.
And I'm not even sure I got the right parts here, because it doesn't look like I do have, but let's try that. Mr. Burris, I am looking at HI 796DE3. Is that the correct amendment?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, yes, I believe that was the one that you wanted
okay.
to offer.
Do I dare move that, or is that the wrong language?
I think we'll take your motion that you would like to adopt this.
Yes, I'd like to adopt this.
Okay. All those in favor? Or what? I'm sorry. Oh, we also have an amendment to the amendment?
Yes.
No.
We do.
Okay, so whatever. Okay. We're just going to proceed to adopt the delete all for the H1796DE3. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, you are now in order to proceed.
I think that we should amend the amendment now at this juncture, or amend the bill with the H1796A4. I think that would be proper, or would it not, Mr. Burris?
Okay, so you're now moving amendment number four.
I'm not moving this. I think that Representative Runbeck is moving it.
Representative
Runbeck. And thank you, Madam Chair. I thought possibly you'd get your delete all going, and then we'd discuss that, and then we'd discuss my amendment. Is that right?
Okay. No problem. We can do that then. Representative Earhart, if you'd proceed. To you.
This is an effort called Work Zone and Safety, or Orange Cones, No Phones. You like that? Orange Cones, No Phones. Does that resonate? This has come about because there have been a number of incidents of death and injury in work zones, and it really started rolling in October of 2011 that the Egan Company had two workers killed as a result of careless driving in a work zone. And we went over this. This was reviewed for you in our meeting, whenever that was, a couple weeks ago. We had an ad hoc group formed to address work zone safety at that time. Associated General Contractors of America, Union, State Patrol, MnDOT, and others met over the last summer and formed this bill. It has a number of things, including a flat rate for fines for speeding in work zones and or flagger violations. Those that stand with the flag and won't let you pass because of traffic is one way. People drive right by that, and so they go head on into traffic coming the other way. It prohibits cell phones use in work zones when workers are present, and authorizes a pilot program for automated speed enforcement in five work zones over a 13 and 14, I think it is, or 14 and 15, and then terminates on that, aspect. So I'm calling on Tim Werke, Associated General Contractors, to describe the bill.
Welcome to the committee, and if you'll identify yourself again.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, committee members. For the record, my name is Tim Werke. I represent the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. We're a construction trade association of vertical and highway contractors. Representative Earhart basically covered the high points here. This was in front of the committee in a preliminary session hearing about 2 weeks ago. And I'm just going to basically quickly, in the interest of time, review some of those high points, and then I can help summarize the bill or walk the committee through it if they so choose. But the basic premise and starting point for this bill is that work zone safety is being compromised more and more. And it has been quite some time since we've looked at, generally as a state, at a broad policy level of work zones and work zone safety. And during that time, things, society and cultural developments have changed, and traffic has increased, speeds have increased, and our contention is that work zones have become more unsafe, and that in consequence workers' safety has been compromised as well. And I think it does bear restating that we have lost two lives recently with respect to that, and the members of Egan Company's executive team are here today in support of the bill because of that. But I've passed out some information in the past, some of the paperwork going around. A national survey by our parent organization, AGC of America, in 2012, 68% of all construction work zones in the country that year experienced some kind of an accident. 28% reported workers were injured, and sadly 18% reported at least one fatality. In Minnesota, Department of Public Safety data reports over the past 5 years, there's been 28,000 work zone crashes, 4,000 injuries, and 41 deaths. The deaths are vehicle occupants as well as work zone workers, but 41 deaths in Minnesota in the last 5 years. So clearly there's an issue here. So Representative Earhart had participated. He mentioned a group, and you've got a list of the basically organizations that were part of a group that I pulled together this past fall to work on this issue. And we came up and settled upon some of the things that are before you in this bill, and some of the things, in fairness, I need to say we could not agree upon, but are in the bill for your consideration as well. If I can basically, and maybe not in order, go through what is in the bill, but the basic premise is a change to the fine structure for speed zone violations. I think all of the practitioners agreed in the room, including representatives of enforcement and MnDOT, that the current fines double in work zones has lost its public effectiveness. It's lost its meaning, in that generally there seems to be agreement that going to a high dollar minimum fine that is clearly delineated on the sign, and in this case in the bill, a violation would be a minimum of $300, that when that is posted, that has the best impact on eliciting a change behavior for the driver. And that is, I should mention, when workers are present. Additionally, the flagger violation, we wanted to change that level of fine to be commensurate with the speed violation. One issue with the flagger violation, which you'll see reflected in the bill, that I should draw your attention to, is that on page 3, is that the violation is tied to similar enforcement as it, the current school bus stop arm violation statute is administered, meaning that if a flagger denotes someone has disobeyed their order to stop or proceed slowly, that flagger can get that information and report it to a peace officer, and that peace officer then lines 3.12 to 3.15 would have 4 hours and probable cause to find that person and issue a citation. We feel if we just increase the fine in that section without including this, the fine means nothing because you can't, there oftentimes is not a peace officer out there to help with the witness aspect of that violation. The revenue streams that would be, or revenues that would be generated from these fines then further in the bill are directed into a special revenue fund within MnDOT, and then that special revenue fund would be dispersed to support two activities, one being enhanced enforcement from the state patrol in work zones, which has, everyone I think agrees, has tremendous effectiveness, and secondly, to support a prospective work zone safety public awareness campaign that MnDOT would then put together. Representative Earhart mentioned orange cones, no phones. A cell phone ban in construction work zones when workers are present. I need to stress that again, when workers are present. We feel strongly that the construction work zone represents a changed driving condition, a physically altered, oftentimes physically altered changed driving condition that demands the driver's 100% attention. And being on a cell phone or any other activity that diminishes your attention to that work zone, we think puts workers at safety or at risk, and therefore we think it is time to begin a serious public discussion about a cell phone ban in construction work zones. The other provision in the bill deals with photo enforcement. This was not part of our group discussion. We did discuss it. We did, we did have a robust discussion, but there was a general feeling that this body has struggled with that issue in the past and that we did not want to jeopardize other provisions of the bill. But Representative Earhart felt that inclusion for this committee to have that discussion was appropriate, and so therefore it is in the bill. It is a pilot project for five pilot programs or five pilot work zones that MnDOT then would monitor and a report on, which leads me to the last section of the bill, requiring an annual report by MnDOT on things like the expenditure of the revenues in the Special Revenue Fund, and also a summary and full accounting of how the pilot project for photo enforcement was managed and handled. That basically is what is in the bill right now. Again, we feel strongly in the industry that work zone safety needs to be addressed. It's time to have that discussion. And sadly and unfortunately, I'm here before you because of a tragic accident. So with that, I'll just stand for questions and anything that you may have otherwise.
Are there any questions? Okay, pardon. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a question, actually a couple questions, but starting with Representative Earhart, could you refresh my memory? The day of that testimony, whenever it was, 3 weeks ago or whatever, with regard to the two unfortunate accidents on 35, was the cell phone the major cause of that in the follow-up investigation?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't think cell phones are involved.
Okay. And Madam Chair, for Mr. Werke, just a little bit ago you were talking about the ineffectiveness of these signs out there that say fines double in work zones. And people are just kind of blowing it off and doing their own thing when they're going through there. And yet, in your follow-up statement, you say that by increasing the fee, this fine is going to enhance that a little bit more. And then, I mean, that's a fascinating statement to me right there. Because if people are blowing off one sign, why wouldn't they blow off another sign? And then you follow this up with this comment about a revenue stream. And anytime I hear that from government, my ears go way up. Because what you're saying is that your comment was this revenue is going to fund enhanced enforcement and work zone safety programs. So therefore, unless I'm out of my mind, the more people that violate these work zone thing incidences, the more money is going to be out there. And that to me is almost like reverse psychology.
Mr. Werke.
Madam Chair and Representative, a good point, and arguably I used a poor choice of words. With regard to the sign legend, I think later on MnDOT is going to come up and they can speak to the effectiveness of that. But the general contention is that fines double in work zones is meaningless because I don't know if my fine is going to be $35 or $350. So if it doubles, what is the actual fine or the penalty that I'm paying? Whereas a clearly delineated high threshold minimum level fine gets my attention. It is being done this way in other areas of the country, in particular in Illinois, where they have a situation where they have, if you hit a worker, the sign says a minimum 1 year in jail and a $10,000 fine. With respect to whether or not the revenue or the fine penalties are sufficient to fund those other activities, I fully understand and respect your point. And again, poor choice of words on my part. However, we wanted to tie back some level of enforcement and support for that enforcement. Currently, my understanding is that MnDOT dips into their construction budget to pay for enhanced enforcement for the state patrol out there. And I think the practitioners will tell you that really the things that get the driver's attention are enforcement. And when you see a patrol officer or a peace officer at the beginning of that work zone, you will see people begin to slow down. Short of that, we have to find other ways to get people's attention.
Representative Anderson.
No further thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions before we proceed? Okay. The next two, if they would come down together, Roger Kretman and Andy Snow.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Rosenthal, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and either Representative Testifier. How long is the data captured for? Do you know?
Mr. Werke?
I presume, Representative, you're probably referring to the photo enforcement piece?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd prefer Representative Earhart.
Okay. Representative Earhart.
I don't remember what we did with that. And perhaps that is a might be a question for the next committee, which is the civil law.
That's why I'm asking. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, procedurally, and I'm looking at my colleague, Kitty Wampus from here, Representative Hornstein. If there are fines in this and a new account being set up, shouldn't this be going to Transportation Finance, or is it going to Judiciary instead? And why are we skipping a stop if the account stays in there?
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Beard, that's a good question. I feel like the right now we got to get this judiciary policy and public safety policy done, and you know, if we can collaborate together on this and both caucuses and see if you feel the need for it to go to finance. But you know, at this point we want to get the policy right, and it should go to civil law from here, I believe.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee. If you'd identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Roger Kretman. I'm the business manager of IBW Local Union 292, Minneapolis Electrical Workers. I thank you for the opportunity to speak on this House File 1796 bill. IBW Local 292 represents just under 5,000 workers in the electrical industry. Hundreds of our workers work on Minnesota highways and roadways in work zones. I know firsthand that this is an extremely dangerous place to work. On October 13, 2011, IBW Local 292 lost part of our family. Two of our members, two of our brothers, two husbands and fathers, Ron Rakowski and Craig Carlson. In the electrical industry, everyone's number one goal is to go home safely at the end of the workday. Unfortunately, that goal was not met on that day. Ron was not able to go home to his wife, Jody, and their two sons, and Craig to his wife, Deb, and their two daughters. This bill makes a great step on improving the workplace safety. IBW Local Union 292 supports this bill. Enacting this bill will help us reach that goal of assuring that all workers are able to go home safe, go home the same way that they went to work, safely and in one piece at the end of their workday. Again, thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Any questions? Next, could we have Peter Buchan and Dennis Flaherty? Or is it, what? Oh, that's okay. Is Peter? That's.
Oh, you know.
We were going to testify.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, you're still testifying. Okay. Oh, what? Is that the list?
And I'm sure he has a handout also. We could get some.
I apologize. I think we need to strategize here regarding the amendment.
Don't go away, Matt.
Okay, so what are we trying? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, sorry, she's got there. Okay. All right, so what we're going to do next is hear from Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A4 amendment.
Here, I got it.
And I also have a handout with that. I don't know if there's a page who can do that. Half of it or all of it? Okay.
Lost the A4. Thank you. Okay, here it is. I found it.
And Madam Chair and Representative Earhart, when we had the meeting a couple weeks ago about this bill, it was sort of notable to me that the whole thing talked about an increasing fine, but it did not talk about reducing the speed limit within the work zone. And, you know, leaving the current law at 55 to me does not seem like it really is going to give us much more of a safety advantage, because that's a pretty high speed limit. And so my amendment is based on the Michigan law. This is the handout here, but it would say that in those work zones the speed limit is adjusted to 45 miles an hour, and that there would be, but it does not apply where you've got the positive barriers erected on the traveled portion of the highway. It would not happen if the speed limit was established as a lower speed limit in a different subdivision of the statute. And some other speed limit could be used if engineering and traffic investigation warranted. So, but for all other situations, work zones would go to 45 miles an hour when workers are present. So I would urge us to adopt this. Otherwise, to me, the bill seems like it's working a lot of different angles to increase safety, but, you know, speed being, I would imagine, one of the bigger issues. We would also pick this up in this amendment.
Representative Earhart, do you want to respond, or would you like to have your next testifier come?
No, I removed the amendment. Or
okay.
We need to take a vote if she has moved the amendment.
Okay.
We can incorporate it.
Yeah. Well, I didn't. I don't think I've moved it. I'll move the A4 amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Okay, the motion is adopted. Okay, now would the representative from MnDOT like to come to the table?
Mm-hmm.
please proceed. And we're getting close to the hour of where we should adjourn, so if you could be as brief as possible. Thank you.
Madam Chair and representatives, my name is Peter Buchan. I'm the Assistant State Traffic Engineer with MnDOT's Office of Traffic Safety and Technology. I'm here to provide a little information and background related to speed limits and work zones in the two handouts that you have coming around. I will refer to, but won't read from them directly. MnDOT, myself included, are very interested in improving work zone safety and ensuring the safety of our workers. The people who work there are our family, our friends, our co-workers. We're very concerned for their safety, as well as for the motorists that travel through the work zones. Compared nationally, Minnesota ranks is always in the top ranked as far as a safety record, with the fewest fatalities in the country for the past few several years. By comparison, in work zones, we were substantially lower than the national average in 2012. Unfortunately, in 2013, the number of fatalities, the preliminary number of fatalities, increased to 8 people dying in our work zones, all of whom were either motorists or vehicle occupants. Speed limits and signs are an affordable, easy way to do things. Unfortunately, they are not very effective. The public often doesn't obey the speed limit signs. Those yellow vests that you see are very effective and very cost-effective, and they do grab people's attention. Unfortunately, a speed limit sign doesn't seem to have that same effectiveness. The things that influence speed, from our experience with work zones and just in general, we struggle with speeds on our roadways, are the presence of enforcement and the presence of workers. When enforcement is present, as we often provide on some of the larger projects, where the officer is present, when they approach the patrol cars, we will see speeds reduce considerably, at least while they're in the presence of the officer. When they see work zones and they see those yellow vests, that also causes drivers to behave differently and bring down their speeds. I'm going to refer to the single page table that you have that's titled Speed Limits and Work Zone Guidelines, a summary chart. First, before getting into the first speed limit here, I'll explain the posted speed limits that are on the roads today that you see when you're not in a work zone. We establish speed limits based on an engineering and traffic study on all state highways. That includes looking at considering the speeds that the motorists are driving, the environment that the work zone's in. Is it in an urban area? Is it in a rural area? The design of the roadway, how wide are the lanes? How wide are the shoulders? The alignment of the roadway, is it curvy? Is it straight? And the nearness of hazards to the edge of the roadway. Based with that information in mind and within the statutory limits, we establish a speed limit for those roads. In a work zone, and I'll start at the bottom of this sheet, there is a 24/7 construction speed limit, as it's referred to here. And that changes the authorized posted speed limit on the road for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's available to us, and when we're looking at a work zone and first doing the planning to consider this, we take into account, again, those conditions, as well as how it changes in the characteristic of the work and the nearness of the workers. We take that into consideration and determine whether or not that speed limit should be reduced, whether or not workers are present 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Given that we can do that, we can further then, and I'll go up the chart from the bottom, the workers' present speed limits. So when workers are present within the project engineer has the authority to reduce the speed limit when workers are present, in addition to what we just reduced it to 24/7. So I'll give you an example. On Interstate 35 near Faribault, we piloted some different speed limit signs that were programmable. They were an LED sign that could be programmed from an iPad by the contractor from the truck. In that instance, we lowered the speed limit on Interstate 35 from 70 to 60 miles per hour, 24 hours a day, because the character of the work, we felt that the motorists, whether or not there were workers' presence, needed to slow down in that area for their own safety. when workers were present using those signs, we reduced it another 15 miles per hour, which now made the speed limit go from 15 to 60, 24 miles an hour, or 24 hours a day, down to 45 miles an hour when workers were present. And those signs are supposed to be removed when workers are not present. Or some of the projects at Interstate 35, an example, are very long and go for several miles, yet the work is confined to a half-mile section. So the intent is to lower that speed limit where the workers are and allow the speeds to go back up to the other posted speed limit for the remainder of the job. We find that that works very effectively. We gathered some data. We found that those signs were effective, and they are available for use on all construction projects. As we move further up the chart, this gets into the advisory speed limits, and it says worker and road conditions. And the worker speed limits are for when workers are present. The road conditions tell you you should make changes and adjust your speed. The motorist needs to make that consideration and that judgment call. Given that, work zones are very are unique, and each one requires different considerations. So I don't feel that the amendment to increase the speed limit, I think it reduces our flexibility to make the judgment in these unique situations along the work zones. And it also increases the reliance on enforcement to try and have people comply or force them to comply to something that they don't feel is necessary as they're driving through the work zone. With that, I guess I know in the interest of time you don't want me to get too long-winded, so I'll kind of stop there and pause. Madam Chair.
Representative Beard, is your question is of the person testifying?
Yes.
Otherwise, we're going to hold this.
Are we going to hold the bill for? Oh, good. Okay, thank you. Because there's a lot to talk about, this, Madam Chair. This is a big issue. Mr. Buchan, it's good to see you again. And I was going to ask, make some comments about the, particularly the flashing signage, where the workers are present, and how highly I regard that. And from what I hear and talking to my friends in the industry, that has been much more effective than just a blanket six-mile work zone and drop everybody to 45, which drives motorists crazy. You know how motorists get. But actually being able to move that LCD sign to where the workers are at and dropping the speed limit there seems to be much more effective and actually accommodates. I know there's the dynamic tension that your department's under. Move traffic, keep it moving safely without jerking the speed around a lot, but still protect the workers. Having it actually where the workers are working on a particular day is just something I'm a big fan of. I'm glad to hear that we're actually doing that. Another thing would be those little kind of like radar signs, your speed is, you know, it kind of measures the speed of the traffic. I notice those get a lot of attention from drivers, especially whenever their number is bigger than the recommended speed. It's like you're calling them out, and it helps folks slow down. One thing I wanted to ask, though, is, and I know that one of the things the contractors are concerned about is who pays for this in the budget if we're going to put these additional safety features on. If we have an officer present, which is to me strikes me as the best enforcement mechanism, somebody with their flashers on or just being present in a work zone really gets the motoring public's attention. Is that just part of the State Patrol budget, part of what they do for us, or are they able to bill MnDOT, or do the contractors have to pick that cost up? Can you help us understand that?
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, that's taken off of the top of the construction budget.
It is.
So it is not charged to the contractor, nor is it charged to the district where the contract is taking place. It's charged to the overall, it comes off the top of the overall construction budget for the state. Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, there's a lot more we could talk about there, but thank you for telling us this is going to be here again, because this is an important bill and it needs to be vetted pretty thoroughly by this committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, I apologize. We are going to lay this over till our next meeting, and again, I apologize to the people who have not been able to testify as well. We are adjourned.